Clearly then, the Spartans, by bestowing on Themistocles his 300 escorts, were aiming to remind him not only of the sacrifice they had made at Thermopylae, but of the dangers that still menaced them in their own backyard. By the time the Hippeis, arriving at Tegea, came to salute their guest and bid him godspeed, the point would have been rammed well and truly home. The Spartans had not the slightest intention of sending an army north of the isthmus. Which was hardly, from Themistocles' own point of view, the ideal boost to his career. Reports of the honours paid to their admiral did not greatly console the Athenian people as they shivered and went hungry amid the blackened ruins of their city. Anger and resentment began to grow in the squatter camps that now dotted the city. The hoplite class, whose loathing of Themistocles had only been fueled by his crowing after Salamis, could suddenly smell his blood. Voters, as had been proved time and again in the brief history of the democracy, have lethally short memories. Come the February elections, Themistocles' reward for having saved his city was to be removed from the command of his precious fleet. The admiralship was awarded instead to Xanthippus. Command of the land forces went to, who else? Aristeides. The impact of these changes on Athenian policy was immediate and far-reaching. Energies that had previously been devoted to the fleet were now diverted towards preparations for a second marathon. In spring, when the allied squadrons assembled at Aegina, the Athenians were noticeable by their absence. The Spartans, who had signalled their own enthusiasm for a naval campaign by sending royalty, in the not altogether inspiring person of King Leotokides to command it, found the Athenians obdurate. No ships would be contributed to the allied fleet until the Spartans had committed manpower to an expedition north of the isthmus. The Spartans, calling the Athenians bluff, refused to buy the deal. The result was stalemate. Leotokides, with barely 100 triremes under his command, skulked around off Delos, too nervous of the Persians to sail any further eastwards. Meanwhile, the Persian fleet, correspondingly nervous of the Greeks, skulked around off Samos. The Peloponnesians skulked behind their wall. Mardonius, knowing that he had no hope of winning his satrapy unless he could lure the Spartans north of the isthmus, or somehow secure the Athenians' fleet, skulked in Thessaly. The Athenians, trapped impotently in the middle, had little option but to skulk as well. And so the deadlock continued all the way into May. It was Mardonius who finally moved to break it. Wearying of secret diplomacy, yet reluctant to jeopardize its potential fruits, he decided to place the great king's terms openly on the table before advancing south from Thessaly. But a sense of the preciousness of freedom, instilled in the Athenian people by the 30-year experiment that was their democracy, and by the experience of having fought to defend it against the most terrifying odds imaginable, had left the assembly unwilling now to barter it for peace. "The degree to which we are put in the shadow by the Medes' strength is hardly something that you need to bring to our attention. We are already well aware of it. But even so, such is our love of liberty that we will never surrender." Brave words indeed. For the Athenian people, having uttered them, once again faced the prospect of their city's annihilation. And the Spartan ambassadors? It's hard to believe that they were not moved by such defiance. Even as they left Athens, the squatter camps were starting to empty as evacuees, for the second time in 10 months, began pushing their handcarts down to the beaches. "Get your army into the field as soon as you can," such had been the parting words of Aristeides. "Quickly, before Mardonius appears in our country, you must join with us and confront him in Boeotia."